To the Tuesday, June 9th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules, and thank you members who are on time. And we have several bills up. Some of them have House sponsors that will be joining us taking a break from their floor session, which is currently going on. But we do have one Senate bill that we're going to start with. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 410. And Erin, would you tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 410 requires co-chairs of Joint Committee on Ways and Means to serve as co-chairs of Joint Legislative Audit Committee. You have a -1 amendment which restructures the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, creates 10-member Joint Legislative Audit Committee to consist of co-chairs of Ways and Means, 4 members of the House of Representatives, 2 of whom must serve on Ways and Means, 4 members of the Senate, 2 of whom must serve on Ways and Means, and designates co-chairs of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means as co-chairs of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. You have a no revenue, no minimal impact on the -1 amendment.
And Senator Devlin is the chief sponsor and has joined us to tell us about his bill and the amendment. So welcome, Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope that I am somewhat persuasive today. I also hope that I have some degree of clarity today, because if you knew that I had been spending hours just going over numbers one after another, line by line, it's kind of hard to get back to this environment here and to speak in a coherent fashion, particularly since your talking points have been handed to you as you walk into the room, even though you've seen them sometime before. So I'll try not to follow them word for word, but I'm afraid I probably will be to some extent, because I'm trying to make it very clear what I'm trying to do here. So thank you very much, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. SB 410, which is a bill that would require that the co-chairs of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means to serve as the co-chairs of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. There is also a -1 amendment that notes that the makeup of the Joint Legislative Audits Committee, in addition to the Ways and Means co-chair serving as the Legislative Audits Committee, that the amendment calls for 4 members additional from the House, 2 of which would be from Ways and Means, and of the 4 members from the Senate, 2 of which would be Ways and Means. So it would be a 10-member committee. You know, it may seem a little bit odd, some of the context of this. The current Joint Legislative Audit Committee, five of the six members are members of the Full Ways and Means Committee, and the one that is not a member of the Full Ways and Means Committee is Senator Riley, who is actually the subcommittee chair for the IT subcommittee of Full Ways and Means. So there actually are no non-Full Ways and Means Committee or non-Ways and Means Committee on the existing committee. The Legislative Audit Committee has a great deal of responsibilities in theory. The reality is that in practice, it has actually rarely been constituted in the original form that it was supposed to be constituted in. Let me go through some of the history of this. Over the past 20 years, there have been various versions of audit and information technology committees in sessions and in interim periods. In 1995, there were separate interim joint committees on audits and on information management technologies. These same interim committees existed in 1997. Then in 2005, there was a House committee on audits and a House committee on information management technology. In the 2007 session, the House had a committee on government accountability and information technology. There were joint committees on legislative audits, information management, and technology during the 2012-2014 sessions. However, during the 2013 session, there was not a joint committee on legislative audits, information management, technology. This session, there is now actually a joint audits committee and a joint ways and means subcommittee on information technology. That seems like a lot of information. But the reality is both of these committees are spelled out in statute, and the membership of both committees have been spelled out in statute for a long time as being statutory committees, and they have rarely been appointed in the same way that they have been defined in statute. At least in the case of the Audits Committee now, it has actually been appointed in the way it is defined in statute. Because of the interconnectivity between the work of the Audits Committee and the Full Ways and Means Committee, I think there is a sort of a natural, let me say, oversight function here, because the Full Ways and Means Committee meets very intensely over the long session. Then we're still, recently the practice has been to actually keep us appointed, but we rarely, if ever, meet. So you take an entirely long, extensive session when you develop issues in agencies that you think should be resolved. And then if you really are independent and get out there, you can maybe do a little bit of work on them. But if you actually utilize the full powers that the audits committee had during the interim, you could get down to some really bottom line issues within these areas. I'll give you a couple of instances. There's been a lot of talk about the recent audit released on community colleges. The audit will be released, has been released. It will be discussed a few times, but that'll be about the amount of follow-up that will actually occur. An audits committee over the period of the next year or so could look far more deeply into that audit. We already know from our deliberations in Ways and Means that there are significant issues, and this sounds a little bit esoteric also, about the implementation of what we call a K waiver, which we did in the last biennium, and some of the implications of that implementation of a K waiver and how it's led to some cost increases that were not foreseen that seem to be to some degree not under a great deal of management control of those cost increases. Things like that we could actually be looking into in an audits committee. The authority of the audits committee is actually relatively broad. I'm not going to read through it, but I would encourage you to look at ORS 171580, because the reality is we have actually the authority as the audits committee to not only work with the Legislative Fiscal Office, but to require the Department of Administrative Services to work with us on audits related issues, to require state auditor to work with us on audit issues, to make recommendations to the Secretary of the State Audit Audits Division on audits that we believe should be done, to follow up on those recommendations, to actually not simply do what we sometimes have done in the past with the Legislative Audits and Information Technology Committee is, and your committee administrator is very familiar with this. When we get a few minutes, review a few state audits, spend a few minutes on them. Because I don't think you actually achieve a great deal by doing that. I think you actually achieve a lot more by taking an audit, finding out what the issues are, getting the response from the agency, and not just doing it once, but following up. And actually, almost in a sense, putting it on a list that you will follow up for several months. So you can make it relatively clear that the issues that you are concerned about are not just merely issues of the day. They're issues that need to be resolved, and they're clear issues of a legislative branch that should be an equal branch of government and have more oversight over the executive branch, and the Legislative Audits Committee should actually be the core of doing that. This bill, actually, the core bill, simply does what I stated. It simply makes it that the co-chairs of Ways and Means are the co-chairs of the Audits Committee. It actually expands the membership because a small committee, well, it could be very effective if you do the -1 amendments, which actually would expand the committee. It could be very effective as a small committee it is, but I think it could even be more effective if it had a few more members. But I still think it's important that the majority of the members on that committee have a great deal of experience with the underlying budgets of agencies, but it's also good to have members on the committee that actually have policy backgrounds so that you could get deeper into some of the policy basis for some of the budgetary decisions that are made. So I think you could actually make the Audits Committee, if you wanted to, into a very effective body for legislative oversight. The reality, in fact, though, is it's been appointed in all different types of forms other than the form it was defined in statute over the last 15 to 20 years. It finally has been put in the form that it's supposed to be put in. It should be actually up functioning and doing the job it was appointed to do. And I would just hope, at least for your support of the basic underlying bill, and beyond that, I could only dream that you would support the larger bill that would actually expand the size of the committee. So I will leave it at that and be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. Did you want to talk specifically about the amendment today, too?
Well, the amendment basically expands the size of the committee. The existing committee is 6 members, you know, 3 from each side. The expanded committee would be 10 members. It's not particularly a big committee when you consider it that it's really a Senate committee of 5 and a House committee of 5. But there are enough people that are actually interested in these issues that I think you could involve them fairly directly in the issues. You could also, in the interim, sometimes when you have a really small committee, it's actually pretty hard to, like, do a couple of different work group type issues where you have so few members, where with a larger committee, it might be possible to have two or three work groups working at the same time, trying to delve deeper into issues. I think the other reality has been in the past is that I think you could actually entice some people to work on the committee if they actually thought the committee actually did work. I think part of the problem that we've had when we've had the legislative audits and information technology management committee, took me almost 6 months to actually be able to say that, is that we had people that were interested in IT and we had people that were interested in audits. But we had not too many that were interested in both. And the reality was is the because people didn't feel like either side of the committee was doing that much, we didn't have that much interest in serving on the committee. Only a few people, I think, really wanted to serve on the committee. But I think if you actually had an up-running, really intense legislative, joint legislative audits committee, it would be a committee people would want to serve on if they actually saw it doing good work. And I think it actually could.
And it looks like currently the co-chairs are required to be two of the members that are appointed, but they're not actually designated as the co-chairs of this committee.
So correct.
That's what the underlying bill would do.
Yeah.
Right.
And Madam Chair, if I might, I think actually, you know, I think in the legislature, it seems like we're all here at the same time, but we actually live in different worlds. There are members of the legislature that you and I never see on a regular basis. And I function largely on the budget side, not on the policy side. But I do think that we get a lot of information as the co-chairs up from our subcommittees in terms of issues within agencies. I mean, issues that if the co-chairs actually had the broad connection to the audits committee, they could follow up after the session and try to resolve some of those issues, rather than those issues sitting dormant, which is what they largely do many times, until you come back the very next session and the same issues are still there. And nobody has really delved into them very deeply.
Okay. Well, thank you, Senator Devlin, for bringing this forward. And did we have any questions for Senator Devlin?
A slew of questions, Madam Chair.
You have a slew of questions.
A slew of questions.
Okay.
Get comfortable, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have served on the Audits Committee at various times over 18 years, and I'll tell you, I think the function of the Audit Committee is absolutely necessary. And I was very curious to see why it had been de-emphasized, and even some of the single-purpose audit work that should have been done on things like Cover Oregon, we discontinued meeting in that committee, and the result was a disaster of epic proportions. So certainly, Madam Chair, I think the Audit Committee needs to be re-energized. So I applaud the underlying logic behind the bill. However, the Dash 1 amendment and the underlying bill create an echo chamber, in my estimation. And I think that does not serve the purpose that I think this good senator wants to serve. Let me give my reasoning. So the co-chairs of Ways and Means would also be the two co-chairs of the Legislative Audit Committee, and the president and the speaker would appoint all the members of those committees. So what I see is the possibility of a committee being fully constituting without any dissenting votes at all, without any skeptics, without any real representation from folks that may not have supported the appropriations that were made during the Ways and Means process, and would want different issues looked at during the audit process. So for instance, you know, one of the interesting arguments that we had when I was a member of the Audits Committee was the Secretary of State vehemently opposed the whole concept of a legislative audit committee, since the Constitution calls out the role of the Secretary of State as the chief auditor. And we had a lot of investment of time and energy determining, or at least defining, that the audit done by the Secretary of State is usually concerned about whether or not the agency is acting within its legislative authority and using the usual and customary accounting practices. What the Legislative Audit Committee wanted was to connect the legislative intent and the appropriation with the outcome, to see whether or not those two things actually were related and whether or not the agency was producing the product that legislators thought they were purchasing, you know, by empowering the agency to deliver. So those were more in line with performance audits. So I think we did resolve the problem eventually that the Secretary of State's purview was not hampered by the legislative audit committee that was really trying to connect the dots between intention, appropriation, and outcomes. But back to this issue of the echo chamber, would you be willing to entertain modification of the Dash 1 amendments that would allow the minority party leaders to have one appointment each, so that what you'd have is the co-chairs of Ways and Means, the Speaker and the President each appointing two other members, and then the full constitution of the committee being made by the minority party leaders in both chambers. And that would give you a lot better opportunity to hear not only from the majority voices or even from a bipartisan perspective, but really you'd be hearing from people that might even be skeptics who want to participate in improving the outcomes. So that's a question for the good senator.
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, personally, I might be willing to consider that. I do not know if our two presiding officers would be willing to consider that, because they might consider that somewhat a usurpation of their authority. Now, under the existing committee, obviously, not speaking Democrat or Republican, but because it's a six-member committee, and it has been the practice usually, but not always by this Senate president, actually, and I'll give him some credit for that, to appoint committees with where his same party has the majority on a committee. That means that there actually are four voices on this committee from the majority party and two parties on the committee, or two members on the committee from whichever party is in minority. I actually think the broader committee would actually obviously put more members on the committee who were from the party that was not in control. But I do not know what the reaction of the two presiding officers would be to that type of change in the Dash 1 amendments.
Madam Chair, I would be happy to undertake that inquiry. The point, obviously, well, if it's not obvious, I'll make the point. There's a temptation, I think, to avoid difficult people. And try as we might, it's very difficult, hard to do that. Maybe impossible to do that in the context of the legislature. I only look at
the good
senator to my left.
Well, my eyes went that way.
Yeah,
also.
Exactly.
Thanks, everyone.
Of course, I do not have to look
Senator Burry,
to
like
my
you,
left
okay.
to see difficult people there all over the place. But the fact is, the minority leaders may choose the person they feel are best suited to pursue the audit information that transparency and efficiency would dictate, because that's an audit committee. But I would be happy, Madam Chair, to make inquiry of the Speaker and the President if they would be willing to broaden the base by sharing that power in a more bicameral, bipartisan way. If you have no objection to me asking those questions, Mr. Senator.
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I obviously have no objections to any member asking any questions of the presiding officers, particularly Senator Farioli, who I've actually, I think, served with here since my first day in the Senate.
Yes.
And actually since my first day in the legislature.
Yes.
But in different chambers at the time.
Yeah. If, Madam Chair, we think if you were able to just leave all the issues to us, we'd resolve them in 20 minutes and then everybody could just go home.
And we wouldn't be 7 to 10 days behind, which means we don't have time for audits.
There are days when I, Madam Chair, sorry, there are days when I kind of dream about the potential of a unicameral legislature also.
But that would be beyond the related classes. Senator Farioli, did you have any additional questions?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. I don't see any other questions for you, Senator Devlin, so thank you. Your testimony, and we will, I'm sure, be looking further at this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 410. And I see that we've been joined by Representative Greenlick, so we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3483A. Erin, would you tell us about this bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3483A adds secular organizations and legislators or former members of the legislature to list of persons and entities authorized to solemnize marriages. It comes to you with no revenue, no fiscal impact, and 35 aye votes and 23 no votes, with two members excused from your House.
Okay, thank you, Erin, and welcome, Senator Greenlick.
Thank you very much, but don't demote me, please. I'm a representative.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Greenlick.
He's a man of the people.
Yes, of course.
Thank you. I really appreciate you hearing this bill, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. It's a very interesting bill, and it's something that came new to me. It turns out when a couple wants to get married, whatever their sex, they go get a marriage license, and then they have somebody officiate at their wedding, and then they get somebody to sign the wedding license, known as solemnizing the wedding. Currently, the only people that can do that solemnization are judges, county clerks. Let's see. Judges. Oh, and clergymen, of course. That happens most often. So, if your wedding was organized by, say, your mother-in-law marrying you, you go find a judge or you go to the county clerk and they'll solemnize the marriage for you. But what this bill does is it adds some other options for some couples who would rather have some alternatives solemnizing their marriage and perhaps officiating, although not necessarily, because solemnization is different. This would allow officials of secular ethical organizations to solemnize marriages, and it would also allow current and former legislators to solemnize marriage. It simply provides a couple of additional options for a couple who wants to have somebody other than a clergyman, a judge, or a county clerk solemnize the marriage. And basically, it's very straightforward and simple, and that's all it does.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Greenlick. Do we have any questions for the representative? Yes, Senator Boquist.
If the good representative could, or counsel, because, okay, what's a secular organization? I see the ORS here, and I haven't dug out the book.
Yeah,
who are we talking about?
So there's a definition in the bill, and essentially a definition that we worked with,
okay,
both religious forces and non, and it's essentially what's known as secular humanist organizations.
Okay.
I think you'll have a witness from such an organization, but the definition was carefully crafted.
I think, and I had the same question, because it's a little bit confusing. The definition is in the bill, and then there's also some reference to secular organizations as indicated in an ORS, but that ORS just refers to how marriages are solemnized under existing law. So, but my understanding is that definition of secular organization already exists in Oregon statute in other contexts and was just duplicated for the purpose of this bill.
Well, I think it was actually carefully crafted. There was excuse me, Madam Chair, there was a sense that it was sort of denigrating religions by a definition that came forward before, and we really wanted to make sure that this was simply an entirely different kind of an organization. They exist there, and I think the definition in the bill is a clear definition of the kind of organization that's intended.
Okay. Any other questions for Representative Greenlick?
No, Madam Chair, but do we need now to refer to 106.150 sub 2 to figure out what secular organizations we're referring to?
Well, actually, that doesn't put any reference to secular organizations in it. It just indicates how marriages are solemnized. So
it says she goes into that.
Actually, Madam Chair, line 21 specifically refers to sexual secular organizations as indicated. I just wondered if I could get an example of what one of them was.
Right. I mean, if you look at the statute, it's the method of solemnization, not what a secular organization is. So
I believe you have a witness who will be testifying from one of those organizations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. We'll let you get back to your floor session.
Back to the floor. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
And I guess while we're on this bill, we'll just keep going. And we have two people signed up to testify on the bill. I'll call them both up. They're Brian Harvey and Kimberly McCullough, if you'd both like to come forward. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Senator Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I have submitted written testimony, but I'm just going to highlight a few things for you. Representative Greenlick already covered some, so I'll skip that part. Essentially, the reason that we support this bill is twofold. On the one hand, it's because folks that live in Oregon that don't belong to a church may want to be married, for example, by a mentor or someone that they look up to, someone that they care about. But if that person that they want to marry them, they want to solemnize their marriage, or if the people who are being married don't belong to a particular religious congregation, they may be a religious person, but they don't belong to a particular church, or they may be atheist, they may be agnostic, they have to get permission from a church in order to solemnize the marriage. The way this actually generally plays out is folks go to the Universal Life Church. They can pay $10 and get a certification essentially from this church to go ahead and solemnize a marriage. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily feel very good for the people who are doing that, particularly if they don't belong to that church. They're essentially having to kind of go partially join that church in order to get that permission. And so what this would do is it would allow secular organizations that essentially play the same role in people's lives as a church does to be able to authorize those folks to marry someone. We're particularly also supportive of this because we believe that it's really in line with the values of the state of Oregon and in particularly the values that are embodied in our state constitution. Our founders were very concerned about religious freedom. In fact, so concerned about religious freedom that we have five different sections of the Oregon Constitution that relate to religious freedom, whereas the federal constitution only has one. And in particular, Article 1, Sections 2, 3, and 20 particularly address the rights of religious and non-religious people and really protect those rights equally. And there's a great case, Newport Church of Nazarene versus Hensley, where we got a great quote from the Oregon Supreme Court that says, it's impermissible for a statute to draw a distinction between churches and non-church religious organizations, and the idea being that those types of organizations that are religious and non-religious should essentially have similar rights. So we really just, you know, we believe that this essentially creates that equality among these different types of organizations, and it also, you know, it also allows people to have the dignity of full and equal access to the marriage of their choice, and really, you know, reaffirms our commitment to tolerance and equality in Oregon. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Brian Harvey. I'm here representing the Center for Inquiry, CFI. We're a secular humanist organization, which would be recognized as a secular organization under this law if it were to pass. And I'm here to encourage you to pass this bill on behalf of all of the amazing secular citizens in Oregon who are leading full and ethical lives, just like our religious neighbors are. And, you know, both my organization and I have full and complete respect for people of faith, but regardless of any of our opinions personally on matters of faith, I think it's important to promote the ideal that our government shouldn't be actively enforcing a religious test for gaining equal access to our shared institutions or equal treatment under the law. So What we want is simply for Oregon to not take an opinion on matters of faith and to allow secular citizens to have the same access to the institution of marriage. I don't know if it was mentioned already, but if you do have a county clerk or a judge solemnize your marriage, that costs an extra $105 in the form of a solemnization fee. That's above and beyond the cost of a marriage license, which, depending on the county, is never more than $60. So it is an additional financial burden as well. The other thing is that most people want to get married at their wedding. They want the person who officiates their wedding to be the person that marries them. And when a secular couple says, "I do," assuming that they actually have a secular officiant, it doesn't really mean much. It doesn't mean the same thing that it would, at least, for, I shouldn't say it doesn't mean much, but it doesn't mean the same thing, legally speaking, as it would for a religious couple. And so what we would desire is that, you know, we remove the burden from secular couples of having to take that extra trip to the courthouse to have the government solemnize their marriage for an additional fee, and simply allow them to have their marriage officiated and solemnized by someone who shares their worldview and their views on life and marriage. And we hope that you will agree that that is a fair proposition. So thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm not sure if I started with that, by the way. Did I?
I think so.
Okay.
Okay, any questions?
Same question, Madam Chair. If I could get examples of what secular organizations are.
You want to go ahead and start with
that? Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I could speak to that at least on behalf of CFI, and maybe that'll give you a window into secular organizations more generally. As far as I can tell, the way this has been defined legally tends to be organizations whose values and methods play the same role in their members' lives as the values and methods of religious tenets play in the lives of religious adherents. Now, there was language to that effect in the first draft of this bill, but it made a direct qualitative comparison between the role and importance of religious beliefs and secular beliefs. There were some of our religious friends who felt that that may not be appropriate or potentially offensive to religious people. That would never have been our intent with the bill, so we were more than happy to change the language. But essentially, it's people who subscribe to secular values and beliefs and have a naturalistic worldview. It is, at least for CFI, that's the case. So they have their ethics, their values, their life stance, their moral philosophy does not come from any religious tenets, but simply from human discourse, I suppose.
Madam Chair, I think we're entering a thicket here. I'm interested. I believe there's enough to support the bill, but I'm curious. So if a group of folks in a secular organization share a mutual set of values that can be articulated and are adherents to that set of values and teach, espouse, transmit, communicate those values, would they meet the definitions that you envision for secular organizations? Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Ferrioli, Senator Rosenbaum, members of the committee, yes, absolutely. And so, you know, an organization like, for example, the Center for Inquiry, they have membership, they have meetings, they have a set of shared values. And so, yes, that would fit perfectly.
Exactly to the question.
That would fit perfectly.
Is the League of Women Voters a secular organization? By your definition? Membership? Shared values.
I don't actually have that. Would you mind reading the text of that? What the secular? I don't have the bill right in front of me.
Yeah, the definition in the bill is: secular organization means an organization whose members subscribe to secular values, beliefs, and practices, and that is not affiliated with or controlled by a church or particular religious authority.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Ferrioli, I would say that the organizations that we're talking about specifically promote secularism and the values and ethics that they derive from secularism in the place of religious beliefs, that subsumes their moral philosophy. Now, the League of Women Voters, a secular can have more than one definition. It can simply mean anything that's not religious. In this case, we're talking about specifically espousing and promoting secular values. The way that tends to be understood is that you're promoting non-religious ideals. Now, there are many religious members of the League of Women Voters, for example, even though it's not a religious organization. So they don't specifically promote secularism or values that would be derived from secular humanism.
And we're getting deeper in the thicket, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I took secular organization to mean non-religious. But secular organizations in our society are myriad. And all of the principles that were espoused, meetings, memberships, a organizing principle, you know, even outreach to others, proselytizing those values, could apply to the Oregon GOP or the Democratic Party of Oregon. There's a platform, there's membership, there's meetings, there's outreach, there's education. They are secular in nature. They're non-religious. So I guess if you really want to be ecumenist, secularism as a philosophy is only one aspect of a secular organization. It isn't the defining aspect even. So I would suggest to you that you're making solemnization of marriages ubiquitously available to virtually every organization in the state.
Senator Farrelly, Senator Rosenbaum, I think what we're involved in here is a bit of a matter of semantics.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
So perhaps this conversation can lay the groundwork for legislative history if this were ever to come up in court. But my understanding is the intention of this is to look at the organization and look at their secularism, right? Their focus on being secular as the threshold, right? And so so I see what you're saying is, okay, anything that's not religious is secular, but the question is that organization focused on the fact that it's a secular organization defined around that? If you look in the written, you know, the Articles of Incorporation for, you know, the League of Women Voters or their documents, I can guarantee you it's not going to mention the word secular in there. It may be secular in that it's non-religious, but it's not focused on being secular. So this is meant to target those organizations that are an alternative to a church. It's somebody goes to this organization instead of going to church.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly.
Many of those organizations that I'm referring to have a principal tenet that their services, their secularism is not limited to by race, creed, or religion. So they are specifically alternatives to religion. They are secular in nature. If you're setting up a situation where you can either be a member of a secular humanist organization or a church, that is exclusive. You're creating an either or. If you're talking about making the solemnizations, if you're offering the right to perform marriages to organizations that are secular in nature, I wouldn't think you just wanted to make a choice between either churches or a secular humanist organization. So, I mean, that appears to be what you're doing here, saying you have to have a specific alternative to a church. It has to be a secular humanist organization.
I'm not, Senator Farrelly, Senator Rosenbaum, I'm not actually suggesting that it be a secular humanist organization. Secular humanists are one form of secular organization that plays this kind of role in people's lives. Mm-hmm. There are certainly other organizations that are that would maybe define themselves around being atheistic or define themselves being around being agnostic. But the focus is we're a group of people that are organized around having these particular values. I see what you're getting at, Senator Farrelly, but I just don't think that the League of Women Voters fits into that particular into what the intent behind this law is.
Madam Chair, I think I get where they're trying to go, but I'm concerned that the idea is if you start making exclusions, or if you try to be inclusive, either way. you're going to leave somebody out. The idea of secular organizations is a very broad definition. That's everything that isn't religious. If you're talking about secular organizations that have organizing principles, that narrows the field. And membership, that narrows the field. And meetings, that narrows the field further. So, you know, I guess I'm trying to figure out what it is that you're really defining when you say secular organizations. If it isn't defined in statute,
it is defined in this bill right here under Section 1. Its secular organization means an organization whose members subscribe to secular values, beliefs, and practices. So secular values, yeah, you could say that that means that that's just a sort of broad anything that's not religion. So I believe that cream cheese is good, and that somehow fits. But it's a semantics thing, but what we're talking about here is the secularism itself, as opposed to using secular as an adjective, using secular as a noun instead of as an adjective.
Is secularism defined in the bill, Madam Chair?
I mean, you can refer to that in the dictionary, but secular is both a noun and an adjective, if you understand what I'm getting at, right? Like, this building may be secular because it's non-religious, but the building isn't designed specifically related to secularism. I don't know. I think we're going to just go back
I'm
and forth
with
the semantics.
Is that
so.
The term secular organization is being defined by a word secularist in nature.
Yeah,
you can't define a word with the same word. So, Madam Chair, I'll be curious about the definition of what a secular organization is. I like the principle of, you know, broadening who may be officiant, particularly the legislators.
Yes,
that sounds like a great idea.
Exactly.
Sounds like a quick $105, Madam Chair. But I think the definition of secular organization has to be better explained.
Madam Chair, can I say one more thing?
Sure.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that in particular here, we're talking about an organization whose members subscribe to secular values, beliefs, and practices. And I do not believe that the League of Women Voters would accept that definition for themselves.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Why do we even have to say? I mean, are there fears of people marrying people and having it be, I mean, what if the Harley Davidson, what if the Hells Angels want to marry a couple of their own members? What's the harm in that? Are there qualifications that these churches have that you, training or anything like that, that you have to go through that you could just expand to general people? You know, why have any limitation on who can do it?
Yeah, Senator Burdick, Senator Rosenbaum, members of the committee, honestly, the ACLU is definitely not opposed to that. If we don't want to have those limitations, my understanding was the original intent behind this bill, and in particular, the original definition was in there, was it was talking about secular organizations that played the same role in people's lives as religious organizations. But it also included the ability of the parties to the marriage themselves to marry themselves if they wished. Any sort of expansion beyond just religion is totally okay with the ACLU. And if that's the direction that we want to go with this and have it, for example, the League of Women Voters, if people believe that the League of Women Voters is what they look up to and that's where their values lie, then certainly we wouldn't be opposed to expanding in that way. But my understanding was that this bill was particularly targeted at trying to allow people who belong to organizations that are similar to a church that play that same role in their lives to go ahead and have the same rights as a religious institution.
So, Madam Chair, it'd be like the Oregon Natural Desert Association.
The what?
The Oregon Natural Desert Association.
Or the cat adoption team.
Yeah, that's a secular organization.
Well, we don't mean to make light of the bill. I think, what we're bumping up against is that one secular organization's idea of what is referred to in this bill might not be quite clear enough in the way it's defined currently, because certainly there are a lot of membership organizations that are secular in nature that might qualify, and maybe we need to either narrow this or clarify it a little bit. So.
Yeah, Senator Rosenbaum, members of the committee, we would absolutely be okay with having whatever conversation we need to have or working with whoever we need to change that definition, just as it was changed on the House side, in order to try to alleviate those concerns. Ultimately, it's a decision of the legislature to what degree you want to expand things. But at the very least, we think this is a problem that atheists and secular and agnostic individuals are faced with this choice. So however that gets accomplished, we'd be happy to participate in that, but we're hoping that we can get that figured out and fix this session.
Madam Chair, it just seems like if we just said non-religious, that would do the job. I mean, who are we to define what is an appropriate substitute for religion or alternative to religion? It just seems to me if we just took the opposite effect of saying you can have it solemnized before a person or group that is religious or non-religious. It seems like Senator Boquist, I interrupted him three times, so please call on him.
Senator Boquist, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, I have a question. Council, I'm trying to put my revenue and finance hat on here, right? Because those who don't know, the government got into the marriage for two reasons, raise money and racism. That's how the United States government and the county governments got into marriage. So I'm trying to figure out in the bill, I have heard, and having been married and divorced once and married a second time before priests, right, and things like this, that they somehow get a certificate. Now, it was made mention here that, you know, who looks at the organization. I'm trying to figure out in maybe lines 18 and 19, I mean, I've always told that these priests or pastors have to have a certificate and sort of be registered someplace. How is it we, the government, or the IRS, or whomever this organization is trying to figure out the organization, who determines who can sign on the form? I mean, I get the idea that judge, so on and so forth. My understanding is, as you know, a clergyman has to register someplace that says that they have and there's some weird ones out there, I'll admit. There's a church of something else that they do online, and they're now a certified whatever minister. But somebody has to determine who is the organization and who actually can sign the form. What is current law? I would assume whatever current law is for lines 18 and 19, who can sign, then that would be applied to this particular organization too. Do you know that answer?
And just to be clear, you're asking if, for instance, if you were to go to the Universal Church, you get a certificate that says you are now a member of or able to. Would a secular organization have a similar certificate provided to a person who can now solemnize?
Because the solemnization is what's filed in the court, mm-hmm. which then allows them to have either, you know, domestic marital rights, tax rights, all the rest of this stuff, which is why government got into it. They didn't care about marriage. They wanted the money. So these other people, obviously we know who a judge is. That's mm-hmm. We know who a county clerk yes. is. Sometimes we don't know who legislators are, and I'm not sure that would be on the list anyway. But having said that, this other category, which is what they're trying to mirror,
yes.
not for or against, is the religious one. And I always thought that they had to have some certificate, and the county clerk or the county where they filed it has to know who they are. It can't just be any member of the congregation. Or is it totally screwed up, and that's what our problem is?
I mean, you can answer. I think we can certainly get legislative counsel.
I think that's the question.
At a later hearing.
If we're going to mirror what they want, it needs to be mirrored for this one.
I think my reading of the statute is that current statute leaves it to the religious organization to determine who's qualified to officiate or solemnize a marriage, and our statutes simply say, you know, we'll defer to their procedures. So. But that's not a category eligible to anything other than a religious organization.
I do know there are counties I have in my district in which, you know, if you have to prove to the county clerk that you are in fact the priest of whatever or the minister of this.
You usually have to show them.
And you have to
yes.
show them something. That's what I'm trying to figure out. What is the mechanism they would use
yes.
if the bill is passed to prove to the county clerk, because this thing gets, they got to, unfortunately, still got to pay this $160 for the marriage license and file it. I mean, what is that mechanism, which then kind of gives you the idea of who has to sign and how do you define them and how they're going to prove that they're the people that want to do this?
Okay, well, I think if we bring this bill back, we can get legislative counsel in and we can get answers to those
yes.
questions. Okay, thank you for your testimony. And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3483. And I see we've been joined by two representatives on a suite of bills. Are we going to?
We do, but everybody else but these three people are here for the other last three bills.
Oh,
so
okay.
This is all we have for this one.
Okay.
So we could possibly do
okay.
the bill again.
Okay. Are you able to just give us about 5 minutes to dispense with another bill, and then we'll pick up your bills?
Oh,
okay.
No. Everybody else here is for their three bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2478A. And Erin, could you tell us about this one?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2478A makes statutory changes to achieve general neutral language with respect to legally recognized marriages. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, we did receive a conflict amendment for this measure. It came in at 3 o'clock. We are working tirelessly to hopefully get the revenue and all paperwork in order to move this bill this afternoon. But the measure and hopefully I do believe the underlying conflict amendment will have a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It was posted shortly after 3 on OLIS to meet our 1 hour requirement for posting as well.
Okay, thanks Erin. And I'll call Barry Pack, Mark Johnson Roberts, and Gina Frazzini. Welcome to our Senate Rules Committee. Thanks for waiting so patiently.
Thank you, Senator.
Whoever wants to go first, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Barry Pack, Deputy Chief Operating Officer with the Department of Administrative Services, and we asked for this bill to be drafted and introduced as a step towards cleaning up some of the statutory references to marriage post the decision from the federal courts in Geiger v. Kitzhaber, which ruled Oregon's ban on same-sex marriage to be unconstitutional. In anticipation of that hearing, one of the roles DAS often plays in state government is a convener of agencies to discuss pending policy changes that are coming to us either from the legislature or from the courts or from executive action from the governor. And we convene state agencies to try to figure out what impact a ruling like that would have had on agency operations immediately, assuming that an injunction was placed and same-sex marriage would be allowed. What we discovered in those conversations is that a lot of the technical issues had been addressed already as a result of Oregon's Registered Domestic Partnership Program. But what we discovered simultaneously was the voluminous references to marriage that were throughout Oregon statutes that were specific to gender. And one of the questions that came up was, you know, where are there places in policy where gender distinctions in marriage matter, and where are they simply descriptive of a couple and could be broadened and made neutral in the case now that same-sex marriages were allowed? And so what DAS was hoping to do was to introduce a bill that was technical in nature. It was purely administrative and housekeeping. It only changed definitions of husband and wife to legally spouses in a marriage now, as the amended version refers to them, and doesn't make any distinctions around policy choices that have already been established in law based on gender. Paternity is a great example. If you can't make paternity a gender-neutral term, and still it's more difficult to do that and still have the policy choices that were established. And so the bill before you today, we took the arguments and the statutes that were cited in the arguments in Geiger v. Kitzhaber and used that as the basis for legislative council drafting, replacing specific gender-specific languages with gender-neutral terms. And that is essentially the main purpose of the bill. And the amendments that were made in the House, the Dash 2 amendment, when we had the original bill drafted and introduced, there were sections of the juvenile code included in the bill. And as we continued to have discussions around them, it was clear that there was a lot more work needed to do with those particular sections of the statute to account for gender distinctions. And so we removed those sections from the bill to try and keep it in alignment with what our original goal was, which is an administrative bill.
Okay. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Senator Rosenbaum, thank you very much. I'm Mark Johnson Roberts. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. For 25 years, I've practiced family law more or less exclusively. A primary focus of my practice during that time has been LGBT family law. So that's the lens with which I view this bill. Has already been mentioned that this bill is a response to a federal court injunction that prohibits the state from denying the rights, benefits, and social effects of marriage to same-sex couples. The purpose of the bill is to rework the statutes to make them gender neutral, specifically statutes in the areas of real property, taxes, and estates, civil rights statutes that refer to marital status, statutes that refer to parental obligations, and statutes that that regulate the dissolution of marriage. The dissolution of marriage, of course, is my primary field of expertise. Same-sex couples dissolving their relationships have had a lot of problems posed to them over the years, starting with the fact that the relationship has to be proven through introducing bank statements and things of that nature, documents of title for real property and so on, because there is no marriage certificate. There is also no mechanism by which alimony spousal support can be paid, and no mechanism by which pensions can be divided. This bill will allow all of those things to take place, and it is a relatively simple update. It's again to align the statutes with the reality of marriage in Oregon. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. My name is Gina Frizzini, and I serve as co-executive director of Basic Rights Oregon. We're a statewide advocacy group working to ensure that all lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Oregonians truly experience equality. And we've celebrated now more than a year of legal marriage here in the state of Oregon, back on May 19th of 2014, when U.S. District Court Judge Michael McShane ruled that gay and lesbian couples in Oregon have the right and the freedom to marry. There have been hundreds, if not thousands, of same-sex couples who've availed themselves of that freedom since that time. And so, in fact, there are now 36 states and the District of Columbia that recognize the freedom to marry, regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity. And as has been true for those other states, it's true here in Oregon that we now must update and modernize our marriage statutes. So as many other states before us have recognized and contended with, there's a discrepancy in the law that exists between what we recognize as married couples and the outdated, unenforceable language in our state statutes that still speaks to only opposite sex couples. So in short, House Bill 2478 amends Oregon's state statutes referring to marriage to be two spouses to ensure all couples who are married are covered under the law. And this also includes modernizing the law around procedural elements such as marriage ceremonies, making the statutes more gender neutral to reflect both same-sex and opposite-sex couples. So while it may sound dry, the bill will have very real positive effects for families here in Oregon. For example, to help ensure fair employment practices by clarifying that married spouses, regardless of their gender, are recognized as the legal and rightful beneficiaries should their spouse become injured on the job. It will also update language for funeral home directors, allowing same-sex partners to make decisions related to the burial of their loved ones. This is an area that is intensely painful time of life for folks, and it's one of the most common phone calls that we get as an advocacy organization is those who are being questioned about their right to make decisions when a loved one has passed away. Along the way, as we've worked on this bill, we have determined that there's more to do. So we will be bringing separate legislation regarding parentage. Mr. Pack referred to that somewhat in his reference to paternity, but those needs will be dealt with in a bill with a topic solely dedicated to parentage. The bill was also amended in the House at the request of Representative McClain. We pared it down to just deal with the references to husband and wife in order to start this process of updating our statutes. So we await a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court on the freedom to marry later this month, and pending that ruling, we'll be back in the short 2016 session to finish the updates both of this set of statutes and also with the parentage issues that we've mentioned as well. So thank you so much for bringing forth the bill, and we would appreciate your support.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay. I don't see any questions for you, so thank you. And we have one more person signed up to testify, and that's Tim Cowan. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Chair and committee members, I'll be brief because I have given you my written testimony. I do not have an opinion, and I have not given you the courtesy of reviewing all the other information that's been provided. The reason why I have the questions that I do is because I know I'll be asked what my opinion is, and I'm going to have to defend it or answer these questions one way or the other. One, what financial considerations will occur with this new designation? I thought first when I reviewed that, will it have any impact on small business? Will I as an owner have any responsibilities added to me? Will there be state or federal exposure? Three, are there other options that would meet all parties' goals or objectives? Are there options that would minimize the negative effect of any conflict between the parties? Can we anticipate that? Is there other definitions like a civil union, whatever, that would be appropriate for all parties? I don't know that. I have heard that in discussions. Does the bill open a door to legalize other types of relationships? I will say one thing just in when I did read the bill, I'm glad I didn't have to read that before I made a decision to get married. I had no idea that existed. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And any questions? I don't see any questions for you, so thank you very much. And we are still awaiting paperwork, or do we have it?
We have it all. Okay. We just need to put it in to meet our requirements.
Oh,
so
okay.
If we just wait till the end of the hearing, we can come back and move.
Or we could suspend the rules and move it now. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Okay, why don't we do that? The chair will move that the rules be suspended.
We need to close the public hearing. Open work session.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2478. And the chair will move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of waiving the one-hour notice on our conflict amendment on House Bill 2478. Is there discussion on the chair's motion? Is there objection to the motion?
I'm fine.
Okay.
I'm voting no, but I'm fine.
Oh, okay.
So hopefully
okay.
Your count's right.
Motion carries. And do we need a brief recess?
Okay. Yes, you do, Madam Chair.
Okay. Committee will be in recess. Carry this bill over. Actually, we may be able to do it by the end of today's hearing, so I don't.
We'll just close
the work session on House Bill 2478, and that just leaves our remaining bills. So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3085, the House Bill 3084, House Bill 3085, and House Bill 3086. And Aaron, do you want to tell us about these? And our legislative sponsors can come forward.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3084 authorizes owner of tract within incorporated boundaries of City of Damascus to withdraw tract from city in certain circumstances, requires filing a request with mayor and governing body, Metro and Department of Land Conservation and Development. This measure comes to you with a no revenue, minimal fiscal impact. It comes to you with 59 aye votes from your House. You have House Bill 3085. 3085 requires City of Damascus to surrender its charter, disincorporate, and cease to exist on 61st day after election. Requires City to satisfy all outstanding legal debts and obligations to expend monies as provided by law and to convey all real property, intangible and intangible personal property, to Clackamas County 30 days after election, refers Act to people of City of Damascus for their approval or rejection at next general election held throughout the state, requires a majority of voters acting on Act to approve the law. You have a dash two amendment. If approved by voter majority of voters in Damascus voting on Act at special election conducted on same date as next primary election, city must surrender its charter, disincorporate, and cease to exist 60 days after the election. No sooner than the 30th day after the election, the city must satisfy all debts, obligations, liabilities, expenses, transfer real property, tangible, intangible, personal property, and money to Clackamas County. You have a no revenue and a fiscal statement was issued on the dash two. You have 3086. 3086 requires City of Damascus to distribute property taxes, taxpayers, all access monies remaining in city funds after satisfying all outstanding legal debts and obligations takes effect only if House Bill 3085 disincorporating the City of Damascus is approved. You have a dash A3 amendment that no sooner than the 30th day after the election, the city must satisfy all debts, obligations, liabilities, expenses, transfer real property, tangible, intangible, personal property, and monies to Clackamas County. Changes the timeline for distribution and property tax years used to calculate amount of money to be distributed to property taxpayers of excess monies remaining in city funds. You have no revenue, and we did receive a fiscal impact on the dash A3 amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Aaron, for the explanation, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Shamia Fagan, State Representative for House District 51. Thank you for opening these bills concurrently. I'm going to be very brief between Representative Kennemer and I. We've met with you all individually to go through the technical elements of the bill. Certainly happy to answer questions, but I won't go through that again with you here. So just again running through, so House Bill 3084 is intended to correct some technical requirements. That we had passed a bill in February that was then House Bill 4029 that the court ruled unconstitutional on a very technical grounds. This bill is fixing that technical grounds, essentially making it where there's not a clear path between a self-interested property owner and the deannexation process, but that there is some evaluation done by someone other than the property owner. In this case, the council itself votes, the public can be heard, and the council votes on the question of whether the disincorporation of the property would cause an undue burden on the city to continue to function. If it does cause an undue burden, the property is not eligible for deannexation. So that was missing in the original bill, so we've added that barrier in between the self-interested property owner. I want to make one quick correction. The staff measure summary at the bottom, it says the measure would require the mayor to determine whether the tract qualifies. It's actually the city council, not the mayor alone. So just wanted to make that correction to the staff measure summary. So that is 3084. In House Bill 3085 is simply a referral to the voters on the question of disincorporation in the May 2016 election. We'd originally, and that's the dash two actually needs to be adopted so that the election is in May of 2016. We'd originally put it for the general election, but at the request of Clackamas County, which Mr. Lyons is going to address, it simplifies everything if we actually don't let that property tax year open. And so we're moving the election date up. So that is 3085. It doesn't affect any other cities, just a simple referral to the City of Damascus on the disincorporation question. And finally, 3086. And again, there's also an amendment to be drafted there that was at the request of Clackamas County. Again, Mr. Lyons will address that. Is addressing the unique situation in Damascus. Normally, if a city disincorporates, and by normally I mean 60 years ago when this happened one time, right? This is not something that happens all the time. The county would receive all of the excess funds in the city, which wouldn't normally be a lot. Damascus is a unique situation because of a charter amendment passed by the voters in 2012, which severely limited the ability for the city to actually spend all the revenues it received. So it actually, for a little city, has quite a healthy savings account, if you will. At one count, it was $7 million. I think there might actually be a higher estimate. So this bill says, with that excess money, all of the city's obligations should be paid, all of their debts, any potential tort claims. Clackamas County is going to have some of those funds to administer, to continue the sheriff's contract, and to continue to employ the city employees, 11.5 FTE at the city for an additional year as required by state law. So the county will be made whole from those. But whatever's left over after that will actually be rebated to the property taxpayers in the city. As a basic policy level, these people have paid property taxes for a functioning city and never got that. And so we believe that the city wasn't able to actually spend those revenues in the city because of the strict charter amendments. And so we're asking that money, whatever is excessive, would be returned to the property taxpayer. So that concludes my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. So, Representative Kenemer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Bill Kenemer, State Representative, District 39. Representative has done a great job of explaining the bills. Let me provide perhaps just a little bit of background. We have a process of in the metro area of building only in cities, essentially. And a few years ago, we set in motion the beginning of a new city in East Clackamas County, the city of Damascus. And it was started, and then it ran into complications and was never able to successfully pass a comp plan. So it could not move forward. So the people were stuck. And there were people who had bought, anticipating that they'd be able to build warehouses and other facilities for commercial enterprise, and that there would be housing and all of that available. And frankly, it just has not come together. And so the question begins then, well, how do you dissolve a city? Well, there really is no precedent for that. So that's why last time we came to you with our first effort at those bills to do that. We ran into some complications at the court. As Shamia has explained, we have a fix for that. Then we also need to have a vote. And we have a problem with the vote, so now we're going to put it in a May election, and majority will cover it. And that way, they can have their say. It's not us telling them they must dissolve. It's them making that decision one way or the other. And then finally, there are monies to be distributed, and we've provided a scheme for that to occur. I think, the votes have been strongly in favor of the city disbanding, and it's an appropriate move. And let's see. And we have Chris Lyons here representing Clackamas County, and the county commissioners have unanimously supported all three bills as well. So I think, and of course, be happy to answer any of the questions you might have.
And thank you, Representative. Mr. Lyons. Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Chris Lyons. I'm the Government Affairs Manager with Clackamas County. And I'll keep my remarks also very brief, just to deliver the news that the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners voted unanimously to support all three of these bills. And we have worked, both the county and our tax assessor have worked with Representative Fagan over the past many months on language that you have before you today in the amendments to ensure that the county is adequately protected from any costs associated with the disincorporation of the city, as well as ensuring that we can effectively administer the distribution of these fees back to the residents of Damascus. And we feel that these amendments would allow us to do that. So we very much support them, urge your support on that. And also would like to thank both of these representatives for spending so much time focusing on these issues pertaining to Clackamas County this session, and in particular Rep. Fagan for working with the county for many hours to make sure that our concerns are addressed. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you all for your testimony. Did we have any questions? Yes, Senator Boquist.
Just briefly for the record, I'm sure I understand, because we've had this a couple times before in the legislature, is there's three bills, but they're really time what we have, they all have triggers and poison pills and so on and so forth. So the vote happens, and then if they decide they're going to do it, then everything else steps in line. And if the vote happens and they say, no, we want to stay, we're back at square one.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, none of them have poison pills, as we would say them. They're all passed the House unanimously, I'll add that. But one of them is a trigger bill. So House Bill 3084, which is fixing this deannexation procedure, there's no trigger. That would go into effect. House Bill 3085 is the vote will happen. So there's no trigger in that bill. And then 3086 is the only one that's a trigger bill. So if 3085 passes, so if the referral to disincorporate the city passes, then that money would be distributed. If they do not vote to disincorporate, 3084 would continue to be in effect, which is that deannexation procedure.
Okay, thank you.
And I would concur with that analysis.
Okay, thank Okay. Any additional questions? Okay. I don't see any other questions for you, so we'll thank you for your testimony. And we have, looks like two more people signed up to testify. Oh, actually, I guess we have people signed up on different bills, but we have two people signed up on all three. Why don't we just call all three of you? So it's Jim Searing, Chris Hawes, and Diana Helm. And our hearing is open on all three bills, so you can testify on all of them, or one or two or three. Whoever wants to go first, just go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum and committee members. My name is Jim Searing. I'm a 53-year resident of the community of Damascus. I'm also one of the leaders for the Citizens of Deannexation citizen group that is formed in Damascus to assist property owners and their families wanting to de-annex out of Damascus. I'm here today with several of my neighbors and citizens in support of all three House bills. First, our citizens would like to thank Representatives Fagan and Kennemer for representing us and assisting the clear majority of our Damascus residents with this legislation. We would also like to thank the House of Representatives for their unanimous approval of these three bills on the House side. Why are we here? A few quick statistics that I could add about Damascus. We have been in existence for 11 years now and are 7 years past due on adopting a state-mandated comprehensive plan. In November 2013, a landslide, 64% of our citizens voted to disincorporate the city, but yet it didn't pass because of an interpretation of one word in the law. In the past 12 months, five comprehensive plans have been overwhelmingly voted down by our citizens, the last one just 3 months ago, with an unprecedented 75% no vote. Why? Because we keep being asked to pass a comp plan for a city we don't want to exist. Some of you may remember last year the state legislature unanimously approved House Bill 4029, allowing our residents to de-annex, that resulted in nearly 100 citizens being sued by the city council at that time. Since January, three new councilors and a new mayor have been elected who are citizen friendly. Thankfully, all legal action against our citizens has been dropped. Thank you, Mayor Helm. And a total of 23 property owners have been allowed to de-annex, with most annexing to Happy Valley, thus attaining peace, hope, opportunities to develop their land, attain prosperity, receive zoning and a comp plan, and have the right to determine the city they want to represent them. House Bill 3084 continues to allow de-annexations. It cleans up the language that House Bill 4029 contained. The Clackamas County Commissioners have came public in support of the bills, and senators, just in the past 10 days, a total of 111 Damascus families and property owners have initiated the de-annexation process, most wanting to go to Happy Valley. HB 3084 streamlines the process down to one hearing instead of the current four meetings that Chapter 222 contains, which is the current process. House Bills 3085 and 86 give our people another opportunity to vote on disincorporation again next year, and our citizen group fully supports the Committee for Disincorporation citizen group in the initiation of these two bills. The clear majority of our citizens, we feel, were denied the right to end the city a year and a half ago. So, senators, we are here to please ask for your support of all three bills. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Diana Helm, and I am a citizen and business owner in Damascus. I'm also the recently elected mayor. I'm addressing only House Bill 3085 today, which would put disincorporation back on the ballot in May of 2016. To be clear, I am not representing our entire city council, but I do represent our citizens, and I do so because they have entrusted me and other new council members to listen and respond to their wishes. 18 months ago, the citizens of Damascus voted overwhelmingly to disincorporate our city. A supermajority bar has been set by the state, and although we had a record number of voters turn out in November of 2013, an off-election year, we didn't quite reach the number needed to end a decade of contention, confusion, wasted taxpayer dollars, and strife. Was the vote to end the city born out of frustration and anger at the previous council? We really can't be sure of that unless we ask our citizens again. We do have a new council, a council that's committed to honoring the will of our community. I can't honestly tell you the current mindset of our citizens, although I think we'll get a better idea at the end of this month when we're having our first town forum of 2015. What I do know is this: our citizens need a choice. They made that choice once, and I firmly believe they need that choice again. That's what House Bill 3085 offers. It's the chance to let us, their elected representatives, know how to proceed. As mayor, I will remain neutral on disincorporation, but I am not neutral on giving our citizens the opportunity to have their say at the ballot. There are those on our council who want to save our city. With a city charter that has crippled us and our ability to function like a normal city, I have to wonder what we're saving it for or from. And until our city charter is changed, which really seems unlikely, we will die a slow death over the next 3 to 5 years. Council will give our citizens the opportunity to change the charter this fall, but if they choose to say no to changing the charter, we also need to give them the opportunity to say no to being a city. What has happened in Damascus is a shame. It's a sad, unfortunate series of struggles, events, mistakes, and manipulations. And while we can't change the past, we can allow our citizens the opportunity to change the future. Please give them that chance with House Bill 3085. They want nothing more and deserve nothing less. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Chris Hawes. I'm a citizen of Damascus and the Communications Director for the Citizens Committee for Disincorporation. I am here today in support of House Bills 3084, 3085, and 3086. These bills all address a common issue in our community. The people no longer wish to be the city of Damascus. House Bill 3084 enables people to move more easily to de-annex from Damascus. This allows those who are closer to urban services to participate in the current housing market, time-sensitive as that market can be. But that avenue holds limited utility for those who are miles and decades away from any urban services. House Bills 3085 and 3086 deal with the majority of Damascus and would facilitate another vote on disincorporating Damascus. We held a disincorporation vote in 2013, had a 68% turnout, the highest in the state by at least 20%, and 64% of those voters chose to disincorporate. The people's votes were then subjected to an election standard never before used or heard of in the history of Oregon. We were told that a majority of all registered voters was required to prevail. The language in the statute was called ambiguous by the Damascus City Attorney, and so 2 weeks after the election, he asked the Secretary of State's office for an opinion. They declined to enter the fray. Feeling that a majority vote of the people was being ignored, we filed a lawsuit to determine what the standard should be. I served as the plaintiff in that legal action. As of now, a decision by the Circuit Court, affirmed without opinion by the Oregon Court of Appeals, has upheld that standard and stated that the legislature is responsible for this unique and unprecedented election result. To quote from the Circuit Court decision, plaintiff's counsel would suggest that it is the city that is denying the people their vote. The court would suggest that it is the legislature, as they are free to do. If this case serves to assist the legislature in clarifying the issue and their intent regarding disincorporation elections, Mr. Hawes's case will have served the public well. End quote. This brings us to today, this legislative body, and the bills before you. I believe all of us are in favor of widespread participation in the democratic process, but I wonder how we are going to ask people to involve themselves in the process if their votes are to be subject to unreasonable and arbitrary standards. Over the last few weeks since the court decision, we have heard from dozens of Damascus citizens. They are outraged that their rights as voters have been cast aside. As much as some in Damascus have declared victory after the court decisions, I believe theirs is a Pyrrhic victory. Their supposed triumph was actually the final gasp of the city. I would offer the opinion that as of today, The only thing that will ever pass in Damascus is another disincorporation measure. Everything else will be voted down by a majority that is motivated and disillusioned. According to the court decisions, the Oregon legislature is responsible for the current situation. I find it difficult to believe that any member of this legislature wants to be seen as the reason for the people's majority vote to be nullified. For our system to work, the people must believe that their representatives are acting in their best interest and honoring the trust that has been placed in them. Absent that trust, participation will decline as people see no reason to play a part when their participation is shown to be unimportant and unwanted. When Benjamin Franklin was asked after the Continental Congress what form of government had been chosen, history records his answer as a republic, if you can keep it. The people cannot alone protect our republic. It requires all of us to do the right thing and fight to preserve a system that is not perfect, but far better than any alternative. We appreciate the effort of Representatives Fagan, Kenemer, and their colleagues in the House to restore the people's votes to their proper place. You have the opportunity to do your part today to rectify an injustice that has been done. We ask you to vote to forward these bills to the full Senate with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you all three for your testimony. Do we have any questions for these folks? Okay, I don't see any questions for you, so we'll thank you again and let you go. And we don't have anybody else signed up.
We do not.
Okay, so I'll close the public hearings on House Bill 3084, 3085, and 3086. And shall we? Okay. Committee will be in recess momentarily. And I'll open a work session on House Bill 3084.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3084 to the floor with a due pass.
And Senator Boquist has moved House Bill 3084 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. Senator Ferrioli, did you object? Okay. Zoe, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer.
Yes.
Senator Boquist.
Aye.
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferrioli.
No.
Chair Rosenbaum.
Aye. Motion carries. And I think we'll assign the same carrier for all three of these, so I'll close the work session on House Bill 3084. Open a work session on House Bill 3085.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3085 to the floor with a due pass.
We need an amendment.
Oh, we need an amendment. Okay. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3085.
Senator Boquist moves the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3085. Any discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Amendment is adopted. Senator Boquist.
I move House Bill 3085 as amended with the Dash 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Boquist has moved House Bill 3085 as amended by the Dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Kazooie, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer.
Aye.
Senator Boquist.
Aye.
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferrioli.
No.
Chair
Rosenbaum. Aye. Motion carries. And I'll close the work session. Open a work session on House Bill 3086.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 3086.
Senator Boquist has moved to adopt the Dash A3 amendment to House Bill 3086. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Amendment is adopted. Senator Boquist.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3086 with the A3 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Boquist has moved House Bill 3086 as amended by the Dash 3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Okay, Zoe, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer.
Aye.
Senator Boquist.
Aye.
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferrioli.
No.
Chair Rosenbaum.
Aye. Motion carries. We do need a carrier for these. There's no Senate sponsor on these bills, so...
I want to avoid a war, so not
yeah,
really.
Not a volunteer. Senator Beyer, would you
sure.
carry these?
Yes.
Okay, Senator Beyer will carry these on the floor.
And Madam Chair, just I reserve the right to change my mind if a couple of sore heads in my caucus change theirs.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 3086. And okay, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2478. And oh. Okay, yeah, so now we don't need to suspend the rules because it's been posted for an hour, so Senator Beyer.
Do we have an amendment?
We do have an amendment.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash A5 amendments to House Bill 2478.
Senator Beyer moves to adopt the Dash A5 amendment to House Bill 2478. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Okay, amendment is adopted. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2478 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation as amended.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2478 as amended by the Dash A5 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. And any discussion? Zoe, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer.
Aye.
Senator Boquist.
No.
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferriol.
No.
Chair Rosenbaum.
Aye. Motion carries, and the chair will carry this on the floor. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2478. And that brings us to our final bill, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2019.
And Madam Chairman of the Committee, we are going to take action on 2019 to send this bill back to the President's desk to refer it to Ways and Means, which is the committee that originally had come from. So we need to return it back there.
Yeah, I think this bill just got diverted here unnecessarily.
This is the Ethics Commission bill, right?
Right.
Correct.
Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. Without recommendation of the Senate President, re-referral to another committee, I move House Bill 2019 without recommendation back to the Senate President for re-referral to another committee.
Not sure I can remember all that. Senator Ferrioli has moved House Bill 2019 without recommendation back to the Senate President for re-referral to another committee. Is there a discussion?
Well, I'll be a yes vote, yeah.
There you go. Any objection?
Madam Chair, I was always a yes vote.
I was always a no vote.
Okay, the motion carries. And that completes our work for today. So thank you, members, and committee is adjourned.
The Damascus bills are just the court.
Members and committee is adjourned.
The Damascus bills are just.